on KBFG LPFM. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, I'll be talking about oil spills at dams along the Columbia River with Lauren Goldberg, who's a staff attorney for Columbia Riverkeeper. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Marvin Gaye. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Oh, yes, mercy, mercy me. We've got our work cut out for us. You are tuned to KBOO Portland, and the time now is just 11 o'clock. Thanks, KBOO members, for your support. If you're not a member, you can still get involved. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member and join the community. And now stay tuned for Making Contact, which explores the Nakba, the Nazca, and the future of Palestine, plus A Dream Remembered, Martin Luther King and the Grassroots Civil Rights Movement. Stay tuned.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Danny V debut EP release on Thursday, April 26th from 8:30 to 11 p.m. at Mississippi Pizza in Portland. Singer-songwriter and musician Danny V is throwing his debut EP release party. Also performing will be Salvatore Manalo and Kea on the Mountain. Again, that's the Danny V debut EP release on Thursday, April 26th from 8:30 to 11 p.m. at Mississippi Pizza, 3552 North Mississippi Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I did it in my childhood, you know, kicking that dirt. At mile 17 to the evergreens, and damn sure do you look good, I'll tell you now.
This week on Making Contact.
Nakba means catastrophe, and it is basically, it refers to May 15, 1948, which if you want to think about U.S. context, it would be like July 4, 1776. It is the day in which settler colonial movement wrests quote-unquote independence from a colonial power. So in this case, Britain, right? It was here in the North America, and it was also in Palestine. And then they declare themselves independent. But it's a settler colonial state that then it's built on the decimation, genocide, and the destruction of the indigenous people. Whether you're talking about native indigenous people of North America, or you're talking about the Palestinians in Palestine.
I'm Marie Cha, and you're listening to Making Contact. Today, we reflect on the Nakba, a word that refers both to the events of 1948, when Zionist militias expelled over 700,000 Palestinians from their villages and towns, and the ongoing destruction and occupation of their lands. Generations later, Palestinians continue to commemorate the Nakba by reclaiming their history, resisting the occupation, and continuing their fight to return home. Along the eastern coast of the Mediterranean Sea lies Gaza, a 32-mile-long strip of land that some have described as the world's largest open-air prison. FSRN reporter Rami Al-Mahari features the work of one Nakba historian who spent years collecting oral histories from a family hometown that he's never been able to visit.
58-year-old Ghazi Masleh points to a map on a wall of his home in the Maghaz refugee camp in the central Gaza Strip. He explains the map shows farmlands in Batani al-Sharqi, the village his parents were forced to flee in May of 1948. Batani al-Sharqi is only 30 miles away, but Masleh has never been there, and neither have most the living descendants of its displaced inhabitants. Once depopulated, paramilitaries destroyed all of the village's structures, except for a police station built by British Mandate authorities in 1940. Misleh has been relentlessly collecting stories about Batani al-Sharqi for the last 2 years and has compiled the research into a 200-page book titled I'm From There and I Have Memories.
حدود الدراسة قريبة البطاني الشرقي وكذلك
The focus of this study is the Batani al-Sharqi village itself, including its important events. In the book, I highlighted the nature of the village from its origin through the first quarter of the 19th century, including the 1948 Nakba, up to the present. My tools for the study included historical research and resources, interviews with villagers who lived there prior to 1948, as well as some related documents that I collected from the villagers themselves.
At the time of the Nakba, the village had approximately 750 residents and was about 1,500 square acres in size. Ghazi's grandfather owned about 50 acres of farmland. Many in the village cultivated citrus trees. Misleh reads aloud part of a first-hand account of the displacement given by Musallam Yunus Musallam, an elder he interviewed last year.
We loaded our luggage onto a camel and fled until we reached the eastern limits of Maghazi. We stayed in a tent, but we were hit by live ammunition. At that time, my sister, Aisha, was shot and wounded, so we fled to the sea in western Maghazi. And when the Maghazi refugee camp was established, we were able to return to Maghazi itself.
The book includes maps and images of people and places of Batani al-Sharqi. The process of compiling the research was a labor of love for a village he has never been able to visit. According to Khalid Safi, professor of modern Arab history at Gaza's Al-Aqsa University, almost 100 books documenting the Nakba have come out over the decades, but they haven't been enough.
We need a collective national effort that keeps record of the Nakba history and a time of constant attempts by Israel to obliterate the Palestinian identity and memory. And I believe that such a collective work is not less significant than any other forms of the Palestinian struggle, including armed and political ones.
The Palestinian Central Bureau of Statistics suggests that as of late 2014, the Palestinian refugee population stood at 5.5 million. Many refugees from specific areas have tried to remain together. That is the case with those displaced from Batani al-Sharqi. Misleh estimates the descendants Batani al-Sharqi number around 11,000 and that most live in the Maghazi refugee camp in a neighborhood named after the village.
Rami Al-Mahari's report aired originally on Free Speech Radio News. To learn more about the Nakba, I visited Rabab Abdelhadi, professor of ethnic studies and the senior scholar of the Arab and Muslim Ethnicities and Diasporas Initiative at San Francisco State University. She grew up in Nablus, the second largest city in the West Bank. It's the place that many Palestinians fled to during the Nakba. Professor Abdelhadi began by explaining what happened in 1948.
There are three refugee camps around Nablus, Balata, Askar, and Al-Ain. First, before Israel, the Zionist militias, the Haganah, the Stern, the Lihi gang, all of them, basically had a plan to push Palestinians. Call it the Dalit plan, that in the north of Palestine, the Zionist militias surrounded the west, the east, and the south. In the middle of Palestine, they surrounded the north, the west, and the south. And then the southern part of Palestine, they surrounded the west, the north, and the east. So Palestinians could only flee to areas where there is surrounding Arab countries. So this is what created the Gaza Strip, because that's the southern part of Palestine, Ashkelon, Lod, Ashdod. They all went to Gaza. The middle went to the West Bank, right, to Nablus, Ramallah, and so on. And the north went to Lebanon. They made it in such a way, they massacred people. Deir Yassin massacre is well known, April 9th, 1948. Menachem Begin said without Deir Yassin, Israel might not have been founded because they massacred people and then they paraded their bodies. And now the Israeli declassified their archives. The archives are coming out and saying Israeli military commanders themselves and the commanders of the Zionist militia before Israel was founded, before 1948, they all acknowledge that they actually drove Palestinians at gunpoint. So it was a mass expulsion of a whole population. 800,000 Palestinians were all expelled, became refugees overnight.
How did you first learn about Nakba?
Well, it's another layer to the story. You know, I was born and raised in Nablus, and my dad was born in Jenin, my mother in Hanabta, in the West Bank. But my aunt, Khalil, Samiha Khalil, actually, her husband's family comes from Taibe, which is inside Israel, and they became refugees overnight. So they got into the boat with her children, and they went on the boat to Lebanon, and they became refugees because they were pushed out. Also, we used to always hear that Uncle Salame, her husband, was always going to see his family at Mandelbaum Gate, which is the gate separating East Jerusalem from West Jerusalem at the time, to see the family that is Palestinian who stayed inside. It was 150,000. Now it's almost 1.5 million, almost 20% of the Israeli population. So they would go meet at the gate, see each other for a couple of hours. Also, there is all the refugee camps. Kids were coming to school. It's a daily reality. It's kind of like the Palestinian diaspora, the expulsion after Nakba. It's a very defining moment. So it was always present.
Do you remember being told stories specifically about what happened during Nakba?
Yeah, I think my aunt actually like used to speak a lot, and she used to like say, I still remember saying that, you know, the boat almost tipped over and they almost died. She's like always talking about that. Of course, when I grew older, I started hearing other stories. When I went and interviewed the children of the people who survived the 1982 Sabra and Shatila massacre in Beirut, and when I asked them, where are you from? Every single kid defined him or herself as coming from a village in what is now Israel that were destroyed. So you say, Rabi', where are you from? Safuriya. None of the villages exist because 531 villages were completely destroyed by Israel in 1948 and to erase any kind of Palestinian existence. Like some have cactus, some have older buildings. Some, they were kept intact and turned into artist colonies like Ein Hod. So everybody knows where they come from because every generation teaches the younger generation where they come from. It's part of knowing who you are.
I want to play two clips at this point. This is from a website called Nakba Survivor, and this is young Palestinians talking about their family histories and their family's experiences of the Nakba.
My father recounts exactly what happened on July 12, 1948, when my hometown of Ramleh fell to Zionist forces and was declared a military zone by none other than Yitzhak Rabin. My family, along with most Arab residents, were forcibly evicted from their homes and their lands, placed on trucks, and taken to the very edge of town to be expelled. The army fired rounds in the air to scare off the women and the children and the elderly, many of whom were fasting as it was the holy month of Ramadan. Almost 1 million Palestinians shared the same fate in 1948, the largest man-made refugee population at the time. My name is Mohanad El Khairi, Dubai-based Palestinian blogger and activist, and I'm a second-generation Nakba survivor.
I'm from the West Bank village of Ramun, Palestine. In the mid-1960s, my grandfather, Isa Atrash, was Mukhtar of the village. During the 1967 war, my grandfather was accused of housing resistance fighters, providing them food and a place to stay. And because of that, right after the war, my grandfather was arrested, publicly beaten, and sent to prison. And his home was demolished. Because my mom's home was demolished, her mother, and her six siblings were forced to live with extended family. And her father stayed in jail for 5 years. When he was released, he left the country and came to the United States. And as a child, I remember my father on the phone with my uncles or on the phone with my grandfather, his father, always talking about the land, always trying to find a way to go back. It always seemed like he was trying to save enough money in order to go back to reclaim his land, to take care of his home, to reconcile with his brothers and sisters. But when I was 13, my father passed away. Dina Omar, second generation survivor of the Nakba, the ongoing occupation and the ongoing Israeli colonization of Palestine.
So they remember the villages, the cities, the towns from where their grandparents actually came. I think it's also really important not only to remember the destruction, but also to remember that there was life, that people were growing the oranges and the olives and the almonds and the tilling the fields of Palestine. And then there was this cultural life that Yaffa was one of the places where the first movie theater, my first film probably in the Arab world, was made. And what's going on today was actually really, really exciting, is the reclaiming of the Palestinian past and talking about the Palestinian narrative today. And it's not stagnant. It's not some kind of nostalgia only to the great past and so on. But there was life. There was life with the contradictions, with the good and the bad and everything else. There was life. And we are going to both continue to resist the Nakba and also continue to live as a people. And we're going to make sure that the younger generation doesn't forget. And it's not forgetting.
You're listening to Making Contact. We're speaking with Rabab Abdelhadi, professor of ethnic studies and senior scholar of the Arab and Muslim Ethnicities and Diasporas Initiative at San Francisco State University. We're talking about the Nakba, the catastrophe that drove over 700,000 Palestinians from their lands in 1948. After pushing Palestinians off their lands in the heart of Palestine, what remained was under the control of neighboring countries. The West Bank was formally annexed to Jordan, and Gaza was controlled by Egypt. On June 6, 1967, the Israeli military invaded Jordan, East Jerusalem, and Gaza. This is referred to in most U.S. history books as the Six-Day War, but Palestinians call it the Naksa. It means the calamity or the setback, and it marks the starting point of the military occupation of Palestine that continues through today. Professor Abdelhadi was 10 when she saw the Israeli troops invade Nablus.
Under Israeli occupation, so I witnessed the 1967 occupation. Actually, everybody in the building, we hid in my parents' dining room because it's supposed to be the best shelter. My dad was the head of civil defense of the neighborhood, right? And so we hid there, and we all thought that the military advancing from the east was Arabs coming to liberate us. And it was the Israelis, and they shot one of the neighbor's sons, who he went around to cheer, and they shot and killed him. Then it was complete curfew, like nobody could do anything, nobody could go anywhere. We missed, like, I think 6 months of school because Israel had the curfew, and a lot of the teachers went on strike, refused to teach the Israeli curriculum. I also remember, like, walking into school at that time, because then now I was no longer in elementary school, I was in middle school, so we had to walk far away. And you know, when you're a little girl, you're walking around, and then the guys, the Palestinian guys, will stand and, like, make some comments, sexual harassment and so on. But when that would happen, like, I will tell my dad, and my dad will walk me to school or drive me, and give them a dirty look, and they'll never do it again. But the Israeli soldiers used to also be in patrol, and they would, like, say all sorts of nasty things. They were cussed, they would, you know, make sexual innuendos and so on. And I never told my dad. All of us, all the girls, nobody told our parents, as if we all made a pact that we're not going to say. And I thought about it later on, why did I never told? I think it's because what would he do? He's going to feel helpless, he cannot do anything about it, or he's going to go and get beaten up by the Israeli soldiers, because they had the power. So there is this kind of, like, the totalizing effect of colonial power, you know, the colonial military power, and the anger you feel inside about, you know, that's not okay, that you want to do something about it. So whenever people were doing something about it, whether it was Palestinian resistance, whether it was the Israeli military governor will call them to come and they refused to go, everything people did, or signing petitions, like, I know my mother would always, like, people will come and chat at the door, women, and then they were like, what are they doing? They're signing petitions against, or hunger strike. I went to my first hunger strike with my mother at the mosque, you know, right after when the occupation began. So all of this stuff was going on at the same time. So I don't remember any kind of any other childhood. I mean, I don't remember anything else, except I remember after 67, there is no feast, there is no music, there is no dancing, there is no singing. Every time you wanted to laugh or something, my mother would say, what are you doing? You know how many martyrs are there? You know how many prisoners are there? So we grew up, and I'm not saying that this is everybody's experience, but, like, my parents were very anti-colonial, and the whole family. So I do not know any other life.
You know, a lot of people sort of understand Nakba and the continuing occupation as part of a settler colonialism. Explain what that is.
Well, settler colonialism is very different than classical colonialism in the sense that the European colonial projects, whether it is by England, France, Spain, Italy, they went to various places in Asia and Africa first, right? And they ripped off the resources, the raw material, the diamonds, the mines, the agriculture, the tea. That's why there is the East India Tea Company in India and so on. And they've done that, all right? Or the U.S. later projects of colonialism around 1898, the Philippines, Guam, Puerto Rico. That project involves going there, controlling. It's a total system also. It's military, it's social, it's political, it's economic. If you look at the Algerian experience, for instance, that's a colonial project. Settler colonialism is where members of those colonial nations go and actually settle and wipe away or try to wipe away the indigenous people. So we see this in the Americas, by the way, both North and South. We see that in New Zealand. We see that in Australia. We see that in South Africa. So this is projects where the complete replacement or making, in the words of Fanon, the people who are colonized subhuman, kind of like non-being. They don't exist. They're not there. They don't factor in the whole equation. Settler colonialism seeks to do that. And there are multiple variations of it. And it has to do with also what is the goals of each project. So in the Israeli Zionist settler colonial project, it's really erasing any traces of Palestine. And it is necessary for this Zionist settler colonial project to erase, because if you don't erase as a Zionist project, you cannot make linkages to a history that has been actually exploited, the Jewish history. The Zionists who set up Israel actually were not religious, so it wasn't really because of a religious connection to Palestine. Actually, the Zionist movement was offered Uganda and Argentina. They were offered by the British colonialism, Uganda and Argentina, and they said, oh, we can't establish any links. Huh? Let's see if we can actually look at the Jewish religion. And the religious establishment was not involved. They were not involved in the Zionist project. They took the Torah and they said, we can actually establish a link to Palestine and so on. It's very interesting. So how come you didn't establish a link to Egypt where Moses was expelled? So this is what happens with the settlers. So it's very different than the colonial project. I think it's important to think about that because it is not a classical case of colonialism where you can just say you need to leave and just anti-colonial struggle. You need to think about different ways in which some of the people ended up there. And so, and the Palestinian movement historically has said that, yes, this is all our land. This is the land legitimately ours. The people who are there, if they are willing to live with us in equality and in justice and in respect, they become citizens of Palestine. It's sort of like maybe one person, one vote, or maybe a different kind of variation of that recipe that the African National Congress came up with for South Africa.
Mm. How would you characterize the Palestinian resistance to occupation today? What do you think makes it different from what we've seen in, you know, maybe the 90s or the 80s?
I think it's different and I think it's similar. I think it's similar in the sense of the spirit of resistance, is that there is rejection of the colonial project, there is rejection of the settler colonial project. There is actually, see, the Palestinian resistance movement went through ebbs and flows. So there was resistance. It grew in Palestinian refugee camps. Surprise, surprise, in Lebanon, in Jordan, elsewhere, in the West Bank. I mean, this is kind of like the stuff I remember, that probably that's where I got my consciousness. So the Palestinian armed resistance grew. At the same time that there were like the hijacking of planes and so on by Leila Khaled and other people, there was also resistance going on day in and day out. Inside, there were people who were protesting. There were people who were also doing militant action, that many of them were arrested in 1968 and spent 17 years in prison. And then there is also the mass movement, building the mass movement, engaging in strikes. During the 1987 Intifada, there were the tax strikes that people of Beit Sahur refused to pay taxes. They said, we're not going to pay taxes to the Israeli occupation. We refuse. So there was always mixed ways of resistance, which is the way to do it. It's actually, if you want to resist dominating powers, you don't use one kind, okay?
And then at one point after the Oslo agreement between Israel and the PLO, which many of us, I would say majority of Palestinians, think of it as a colonial agreement that legitimized the Israeli military occupation and colonial rule and so on, and basically gave it a Palestinian cover, whereby Israel can actually try to get away with it and say it's not our responsibility, it's the Palestinian responsibility. And many of us are actually now demanding the dismantling of Oslo and basically let the Palestinian Authority give the keys back to the Israel and say, you know, we don't want to lock the ghetto ourselves, you take the keys and you can lock the ghetto yourself, right? But so there was the debate in the Palestinian movement over what sort of resistance, what does resistance mean? Does armed resistance make sense or it doesn't make sense? Today, because Oslo has failed, it has failed in the Aqsa Intifada of 2000 to 2004, 2005, there was also that there was very militant suicide bombing were taking place and so on. It was basically, the occupation is so oppressive that the only way young people felt that they can confront is to say to them, you know, if we don't have security, they don't have security. If we are unable to even sleep the night without getting raids, without our bodies being used as human shields, without our homes being destroyed, pregnant women giving birth and children and mothers dying at the checkpoint, if we can't even breathe, why should the colonizers be allowed to breathe? I mean, this was the logic. Today, there is the boycott movement, which is BDS, which is calling on the whole world to participate into holding Israel accountable like any other country, holding Israel accountable and not allowing it to get away with murder, not even literally with murder, with murder. There is also all the Palestinians who are actually saying we're going to engage in all sorts of resistance in Jerusalem, in Hebron, and elsewhere. People who are refusing to let go of their homes. People who are building homes because, you know, Israel doesn't give permits. People, there are Palestinians inside Israel who refuse to serve in the Israeli military. And they have a big campaign that says, resist and your people will protect you. And the boycotting Israeli products and trying to provide Palestinian alternative, which is very difficult under totalizing colonialism. It is so difficult because Israel controls everything in the economy. I mean, everything. So to try to create like a little bit of thick yogurt from the milk, it's a very tall order, but people are doing it.
The state of Israel's official account of the Nakba differs dramatically from what we just heard. For years, the different accounts lived alongside each other, until the 1980s, when Israel declassified a trove of military documents from that period. The declassified military documents and the first-hand accounts from the generals of Zionist militias confirm the facts that Professor Abdelhadi shared. Many of the Palestinians who lived through the Nakba have since passed away, but their descendants are giving their experiences new life. In New York, poet Remy Kamazi honors his grandmother through his poem, Nakba.
She was scared. 7 months pregnant. Guns pointed at temples. Tears dropping. Stomach cusp back bent. Dirt pathways leading to dispossession. Rocking boats, waves crashing, people rushing, falling over each other, packing into small spaces. Like memories. Her home. Mandated, occupied, cleansed, conquered. Terrorizers sat on hills sniping children. Neighbors fled on April 10th. Word came of massacre. They stayed. Didn't fight. Didn't flee. Shells and bombs bursting in air like anthems. Prayed for the dead. With priests and imams, prayed for the living, looking over shoulders for the Ergun and Haganah. She's a warrior, raised life, planted trees, painted fruit, as if the road was her garden, orphaned twice. Had birth from Palestine, whispered Yaffa till final breath, never knew essence until she found emptiness, 48 ways to flee, and she found Beirut. Bullet holes in buildings, reminder of home, but not home. Years later, Daughter sat on hills in the south, dreaming of breaking water never touched, thinks of their mother, that warrior, how battles still rage here and abroad, orchards flourished. Propagandists called them barons, land expropriated for Europeans who called religion ethnicity, not native, not from here. Plant flags, call it home, rename cities and villages, wiping, cleaning, cleansing memory that this is not theirs. Passed away August 22nd, 2009. Frail hands shook, lip trembled, didn't want to die, but suffered decades. She will speak Arabic, broken English, wounded words and murmurs, her eyes close, but every so often they blink brilliance. Memories that cannot be erased, uprooted, or stolen, she has not forgotten. We have not forgotten. We will not forget. Veins like roots of olive trees, we will return. That is not a threat, not a wish, a hope, or a dream, but a promise.
I'm George Lavender, and this is Making Contact.
My poor little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
It's one of the most famous speeches of all time, and it nearly didn't happen.
Wyatt T. Walker says to King, don't do the I Have a Dream thing. It's trite, it's a cliche, you've used it too many times before.
But on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial on August 28, 1963, Martin Luther King Jr. ignored that advice. In front of what was then the largest civil rights demonstration the Capitol had ever seen, he did the I Have a Dream thing.
Black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today.
On this edition of Making Contact, Gary Young talks about his book, The Speech, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Dream, and the story behind it.
The book is called The Speech, and it's about King's famous speech at the March on Washington. And if left there as an idea, then you have a great man and a great talk. But King could not do that on its own. The speech and the march came from somewhere. I want to start by giving some context to that text, because in the absence of that, there would have been no march and there would have been no speech.
To come.
Yes, I do. And so I start with kind of some of the people whose names perhaps we don't know, but who paid for that speech in a range of ways. And I begin with Franklin McCain, who was a 17-year-old in Greensboro, North Carolina, who made his stand by taking his seat at the Woolworths downtown on February the 1st, 1960. When I interviewed Franklin McCain, he said that up until that time, as a young man in North Carolina, he felt that his life was worthless and that his parents had lied to him. And the lie that they told him was a great American lie, that you can be anything you want to be. And he said, as he grew through adolescence, he knew that wasn't true. As a 17-year-old black male in North Carolina, he knew that that wasn't true. And just as a symbol of how untrue that was, a completely different story that I was doing, several years later, I interviewed a guy called Buford Posey from Mississippi, a white guy who became an anti-racist, who told me, quite kind of matter-of-factly, he said, I never knew that it was illegal to kill a black man until I joined the army. He said, until that time, I knew it was wrong, but I didn't know it was illegal. And true enough, in Mississippi, the people who were as likely as not to be killing black people were actually the law enforcement agencies. So it was not an entirely incredible thing for him to think. So we go back to Franklin McCain. He knows this as well as Buford Posey does. And he says he was angry at his parents for this lie. And so they sat up, him and his friends, late into the night, January 31st, talking about how everybody had failed them before they talked themselves into the action that they took the following day, not knowing when they showed up at Woolworths in Greensboro whether any of the others would be there. He says, we wanted to go beyond what our parents had done, and the worst thing that could happen was that the Klan could kill us. But I had no concern for my personal safety. The day I sat at that counter, I had the most tremendous feeling of elation and celebration. I felt that in this life, nothing else mattered. If there's a heaven, I got there for a few minutes. I just felt you can't touch me. You can't hurt me. There's no other experience like it, not even the birth of my first child. A few years later, in May 63, in Birmingham, Alabama, a burly white police officer attempted to intimidate some black schoolchildren to keep them from joining the growing anti-segregation protests. They assured him they knew what they were doing, ignored his entreaties, and continued their march toward Kelly Ingram Park, where they were arrested. A reporter asked one of them her age. 6, she said, as she climbed into the paddy wagon. The following month in Mississippi, stalwart civil rights campaigner Fannie Lou Hamer overheard Anel Ponder, a fellow activist, being beaten in jail in an adjacent cell. Can you say yes, sir, nigger? Can you say yes, sir, the policeman demanded. Yes, I can, replied Ponder. So say it. I don't know you well enough, said Ponder. And then Hamer heard her head hit the floor again. The Polish journalist Ryszard Kapuscinski once wrote, all books about all revolutions begin with a chapter that describes the decay of tottering authority or the misery and sufferings of the people. But they should begin with a psychological chapter, one that shows how a harassed, terrified man suddenly breaks his terror and stops being afraid. This unusual process demands illuminating. Man gets rid of fear and feels free. The period preceding King's speech at the March on Washington was one such chapter. Until that point, there had, of course, been many fearless acts by anti-racist protesters. But in that moment, the number who were prepared to commit them reached a critical mass. In May 63, the New York Times published more stories about civil rights in 2 weeks than it had in the previous 2 years. During the 10-week period following Kennedy's address on civil rights in June that year, there were 758 demonstrations in 186 cities, resulting in 14,733 arrests. Such were the conditions that made the March on Washington possible and King's speech so resonant. And this context was global. 2 days after McCain made his protest in Greensboro, the British Prime Minister Harold Macmillan addressed the South African Parliament in Cape Town with an ominous warning.
The wind of change is blowing through this continent. And whether we like it or not, this growth of national consciousness is a political fact.
Some, including his immediate audience and apartheid parliament, didn't like it at all. But as a decade wore on, that wind became a gale. In the 3 years between Macmillan's speech and the March on Washington, the following countries became independent. Togo, Mali, Senegal, Zaire, Somalia, Benin, Niger, Burkina Faso, Cote d'Ivoire, Chad, Central African Republic, Congo, Gabon, Nigeria, Mauritania, Sierra Leone, Tanganyika, and Jamaica. Internationally, non-racial democracy and the black enfranchisement that came with it were the order of the day. The longer America practiced legal segregation, the more it looked like a slum on the wrong side of history than a shining city on the hill. Now, the story of that year in particular is the story of the base, the masses, the grassroots continually running ahead of the leadership. King spoke in Harlem just a few months before the march and was heckled by protesters shouting, "We want Malcolm." When the NAACP hold their conference in Chicago, they invite Mayor Daley to give introductory remarks, and he is heckled from the floor. When their leaders go to speak to Kennedy about holding the march, Kennedy says to them, "We have legislation that's currently going through Congress. We would rather have new laws than have the Negroes out on the streets." And A. Philip Randolph, the socialist and trade union organizer who's primarily responsible for calling the march, tells Kennedy, "The Negroes are already in the streets, Mr. President, and I doubt if you called them that they would come back." That is the mood of the moment, that the patience has worn out, the forbearance, the ability to withstand the clubs and the hoses that can fire so strong they can knock the bark off a tree at 30 feet being fired at children and dogs, has become too much. And so African Americans, who are always fighting back, start to resist like with like. In Birmingham, there is eventually they respond to the bombings of the Klan with violence. And there's a fear, both among the civil rights leadership and among the Kennedy administration, that black people will resist and will meet like with like. That is the mood that creates a necessity for a march, which is called at the beginning of the year, but very few people want. The polls show that most Americans don't want it, and particularly most white Americans don't want it. Kennedy doesn't want it. It's insufficiently radical for many of the youth, and too radical for many of the more conservative leadership. But by the time it happens, there is a sense that if they don't do this, then what are they going to do to channel this frustration, this mass frustration? And so the march happens. Now, the key fear, primarily of the state, is that there will be violence. This is peculiar because most of the violence in the South has come from the white segregationists, not from African Americans. But nonetheless, the fear is that there will be violence, and so it is literally policed as a military operation. It's called Operation Steep Hill. 82nd Airborne, ready to fly up from North Carolina at a moment's notice and drop 19,000 troops on D.C. 1,000 troops in D.C. Deployed, 6,000 police working, all leave cancelled, all elective surgery cancelled, baseball game cancelled, alcoholic sales are made illegal. And even on the mic that King speaks from, there is a kill switch that the Justice Department put in surreptitiously. The idea is that if anybody calls for insurrection from the stage, that they will flip the switch and play Mahalia Jackson singing, "He's Got the Whole World in His Hands." That's their response. And so it is into that atmosphere that King plans his address. Now, King gave around 350 speeches that year. So if you take time off for high days and holidays, that's about a speech a day. And generally, he's not giving a bespoke speech. He's an African-American Baptist preacher. And in that tradition, he drafts his sermon, but then he crafts it in response to how the audience is taking to what he's saying. And he has a number of a series of weapons that he can use, rhetorical weapons. But the difference is that this speech, unlike other speeches, is going to be televised. If you were in the black church or the civil rights movement, you'd heard King speak before. But if you weren't, this was his oratorical introduction to the nation. Kennedy had never heard him give a speech before. And at the end of the speech, he turns to one of his aides in the Oval Office and says, "Damn, he's good." And so King and his team want something that is going to be on a par with Gettysburg. Now, we know a lot of these details because the FBI were kind enough to record them for us. He wants something on a par with Gettysburg. And so one of his main aides, Wyatt T. Walker, says to King, "Don't do the Eye of a Dream thing. It's trite. It's a cliche. You've used it too many times before." And that's the first line of the book. And indeed, King had used it many times before. He first recorded using of it was in 62. It's thought that he probably used it in 61. That's a couple of years before. He'd used it in June at a rally in Detroit. And even a week earlier at a fundraiser for black insurance executives in Chicago. So this was not the first time that, by a long stretch, that he had used the Eye of a Dream refrain. And King worries away at this speech. He seeks counsel. He has a lot of input, much more than he would generally. And what we know is that when he goes to bed at 4 o'clock in the morning of the march, "I have a dream" is not in the text of the speech that we know. And according to Clarence Jones, his lawyer and his speechwriter, it was not in King's mind to do that the next day. So the next day, there is a series of meetings they have with Congress. There's a funny kind of moment at the beginning of the day where they're in meeting Congress, and they come out, and the march has started without them, very symbolically, given what I've said earlier. Bayard Rustin, the out gay, ex-communist, conscientious objector, and that's before you get to the fact that he's black. He's the organizer of this march, and he runs out of Congress, sees the march leaving, and says, we are supposed to be leading them. They jump into their limousines and try to catch up with the march, but are blocked by the traffic caused by the march that they themselves have called. And so they jump out of the limousines, and they run to catch up with the march. And if you look at pictures of the leaders of the march, in a kind of Fred Flintstone version of photoshopping, what they did was basically just clear people out of the way so it looks as though they are at the front of the march, but actually they're in the middle. And throughout that day, King is worrying away at this text, scrawling all over it. If you look at the actual, what he ends up with, you know, what's left on the podium when he finishes speaking, it's full of doodles and scrawls and so on.
You're listening to Gary Young, author of The Speech on Making Contact. Special thanks to The New School for use of their recording. To find out more about the show or to download past episodes, go to radioproject.org. You can also like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @making_contact. Up next, Gary Young explains what had to happen to turn Martin Luther King Jr. from an unpopular figure at the time of his death to the widely praised icon we know today.
I can tell from your applause he needs no further introduction. Mr. Bob Dylan.
It was a hot day, 87 degrees at noon, and King is the 16th on a agenda of 80.
Oh, the time will come up when the wind.
He's a 10th speaker. There's been the anthem, the invocation, the prayer. There have been a range of a number of singers, including Mahalia Jackson, Peter, Paul and Mary, Bob Dylan. A range of people have sung. And he takes to the podium about 2:30.
At this time, I have the honor to present to you the moral leader of our nation. I have the pleasure to present to you Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr.
And according to Clarence Jones, who drafted much of the text, King keeps closer to this text than he would regularly keep.
I am happy to join with you today.
Those who wrote speeches for King said they were always King's speeches, basically, but you would be, in Clarence Jones's words, like a very crude architect. You would set up the four walls, and then King, like a beautiful interior designer, would come and he would make it his own. And King speaks very faithfully to the main text.
50 years ago, a great American in whose symbolic shadow we stand today signed the Emancipation Proclamation.
But then and if you listen to the speech, and I would advise you to listen to it, it's the most popular, least well-known speech I've heard of. When I told my brother I was doing this book, he said, I love that speech. It's such a great speech. You know, that thing about I've been to the mountaintop and I've seen the promised land, and I said, it's a great speech, but it's not that speech. And he's winding up. He says, go back to Mississippi, go back to Louisiana, go back to
South Carolina, go back to Georgia, go back to Louisiana, go back to the slums and ghettos of our northern cities, knowing that somehow this situation can and will be changed. Let us.
Behind him is sitting Mahalia Jackson, a very, very close and special friend. When King was on the road, he would often call Mahalia Jackson for what they termed gospel therapy. He would call her and he would ask her to sing to him down the phone to soothe his spirit when he was down. And so he knew her well, he knew her voice well. And she shouts, tell him about the dream, Martin. tell him about the dream. She had heard him deliver the dream segment in June in Detroit. King continues.
Let us not wallow in the valley of despair.
And then she shouts again, tell us about the dream, Martin. Tell us about the dream.
I say to you today, my friend.
And then, in the words of Clarence Jones, King puts his text to the left of the podium. And in his body language, changes from a lecturer to a preacher. And Jones turns to the person next to him and says, those people don't know him, but they're about to go to church.
So even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream.
At which point, Wyatt T. Walker, the man who advised him not to do that, who's in the crowd, turns to the person next to him and says, oh, he's doing the dream. So that's how we got there. And what's interesting is that when you ask people who were there at the time and who knew King well, to a person, they will tell you that they did not, of all the speeches that he made, this was not particularly one that they thought we would be talking about in 50 years' time. It was a great speech, that none of them, you know, deny that. But many of them have different speeches that they thought were better. And either way, they said great speeches was what King did. And so I spend a fair amount of time in the book looking at why that is. And I want to kind of really suggest two things here. The first is that there is something for pretty much everybody in this speech. If you are an African American, part of a community who's told that you are genetically stupid, that you're poor because you're stupid, that your stupidity is your responsibility, and that the failings in your community have nothing to do with history and everything to do with you, then to know that the best speech, America's favorite speech, was delivered by an African American in the black vernacular as an indictment of American racism is something to be very proud of. If you are a patriot, there is nothing in this speech that you need worry about.
It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream.
Literally and metaphorically delivered in the shadow of Lincoln, that pays homage to the founding fathers, the Constitution and Declaration of Independence. It's an American speech. Couldn't have come from anywhere else. If you are progressive, this speech comes on this day. There have been few days like this for American progressives. Fair enough, only 20% of the crowd was white, which was less than what they were expecting. But nonetheless, this was the first march of its kind in Washington. Now, marches in Washington are two to a penny, but this mass demonstration, they hoped for 100,000, they got 250,000. Had never been done before. And it comes, and this is the way I describe it in the book, it is the most eloquent articulation of the last great moral act that America can claim for which there is any consensus, and that is the end of American apartheid. That whatever people say now or feel able to say, nobody who wants to be taken seriously is calling for those signs to go back up. Nobody is calling for a return to formal, codified segregation. And however small that may seem when we see the amount of racism that can still spew from the mouths of those who are elected or unelected, that is no small thing. The end of apartheid is a big thing. And it's, I believe it's the last great moral thing that America can really claim to have done as a country. So there is that. A number of people have something to claim, but there's also something else. King, when he delivers that speech, there is an even number of Americans with a favorable and unfavorable view of him. By 66, twice as many Americans have an unfavorable view than a favorable view. And then he's dead in 68, assassinated. By 1999, when Americans are polled on who are their favorite characters of the 20th century, King comes second only to Mother Teresa. So something happens between when he is assassinated as a somewhat marginal and polarized figure and 1999. And this is what I think has happened. First of all, why does he become unpopular? Well, when the speech is delivered, the year after comes the Civil Rights Act. The year after that comes the Voting Rights Act. Legislation begins to kick in, and King understands that the end of segregation is not the same as the beginning of equality. As he says, I have given people, we have won the right to eat in any restaurant of our choice, but we do not have the ability to eat everything that's on the menu because we can't afford it.
There are 40 million poor people here. And one day we must ask the question, why are there 40 million poor people in America? And when you begin to ask that question, you're raising a question about the economic system, about a broader distribution of wealth. When you ask that question, you begin to question the capitalistic economy. And I'm simply saying that more and more, we've got to begin to ask questions about the whole society. We are called upon to help the discouraged beggars in life's marketplace. But one day we must come to see that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring. It means that questions must be raised. You see, my friends, when you deal with this, you begin to ask the question, who owns the oil? You begin to ask the question, who owns the iron ore? You begin to ask the question, why is it that people have to pay water bills in a world that's two-thirds water?
Now, that kind of talk in America in 1967 will get you killed. And sure enough, a year later, he is killed. So he starts talking about capitalism. Year after that, in 67, he starts at the Riverside Church. He calls America
the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today.
And takes a stand against the Vietnam War. Now, how is America then going to remember King? Well, it can't remember him if it's going to raise him to iconic status. If it's going to put him on the mall, then it has to sanitize him for public consumption. It has to make him the kind of person who could come second to Mother Teresa. And you can't do that with a man in America who questions capitalism. Because to remember King in that way would not raise him above the fray, it would enter him into it. You can't remember King as a man who criticized capitalism and still hold him up as an American icon. That doesn't work unless what it takes to be an American icon changes. You can't remember him, America can't remember him, the powers that be, as the man who called America the greatest purveyor of military violence in the world today, because arguably it still is. And it was notable on the 50th anniversary of the speech. It took place literally on a split screen. And on one screen, there was Obama, Clinton, Carter, carrying King's mantle, cloaking themselves in his legacy. And on the other screen, will we bomb Syria? When will we bomb Syria? Why wouldn't we bomb Syria? You can't remember King as that, have him on the mall, and still claim him to be an American icon when he's speaking about America being the greatest purveyor of military violence. But you can remember him as a man who got rid of American apartheid. Not American racism, because that would involve a whole different set of conversations about why black men in D.C. have a lower life expectancy rate than men on the Gaza Strip. You can't have that conversation, but you can have the conversation about why or how he got rid of American apartheid. And so that's the way that they choose to remember him. And so I end with just one paragraph where I talk about the process by which King and through him the speech can be sanitized. And I say, white America, most of it, came to embrace King in the same way that most white South Africans came to accept Nelson Mandela, grudgingly and gratefully. Retrospectively, selectively, without grace, but with considerable guile. By the time they realized their dislike of him was spent and futile, he'd created a world in which admiring him was in their own self-interest, because, in short, they had no choice. When it comes to King and his speech, one of the central arguments in this book is it's not just about what you remember, it's also about what you forget. Thank you.
And that's it for this edition of Making Contact. You've been listening to Gary Young, author of The Speech, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Dream and the Story Behind It, published by Haymarket Books. Special thanks to The New School for use of their recording. To find out more about Making Contact, go to radioproject.org. You can also like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @making_contact. The Making Contact team includes Quan Booth, Laura Flynn, Jasmine Lopez, Lisa Rudman, and Andrew Stelzer. I'm George Lavender. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
This is KBOO Portland.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Folk Music Society April Concert. On Friday, April 20th.